Okay, I apologize. We are running a little behind schedule, and I know towards the end of the day, everyone kind of gets sleepy, and it's after lunch, so we don't want to run too late. And if you all can take your cell phones and put them on silent or turn them off, we appreciate that. So I'd like to thank everyone for coming. We're honored by such a large turnout. And before I begin, I'd like to thank Aaron Teeter, he's not here now, but he is the gentleman who is sitting outside and without whom this probably wouldn't have come off, as well as Kuimba Boston, who's with our public affairs group. And I'd like to welcome you all to the U.S. Institute of Peace and our forum on Colombia with the recent political paramilitary turmoil. Now, everyone here knows that since 9/11, and especially in the last couple years, Washington has been particularly focused on the Middle East and Iraq in particular, and to a large degree, rightfully so. But at times, this has been to the detriment to the rest of focusing on the rest of the world, and including Latin America. Nevertheless, Colombia receives the fifth largest amount of aid from the United States, and by far the largest recipient outside the Middle East. Clearly, there are a lot of people here who are concerned about Colombia and its impact on America's national interests. Obviously, we here today at USIP are not going to solve or come up with the answers to end Colombia's conflicts, but we have brought together a strong panel of speakers to address some of the key issues regarding the latest in the long history of obstacles to peace in Colombia. Dr. Mauricio Romero is professor of political science, government, and international relations at, I'm probably going to say this incorrectly, Universidad Javeriana in Bogota, Colombia. He sits on Colombia's National Commission on Reparations and Reconciliation, and he is also author of the book Paramilitares y Autodefensas, 1982 to 2003. Maria McFarlane is a researcher at Human Rights Watch and former instructor of international human rights law at Fordham University Law School. She authored Human Rights Watch's August 2005 report, Smoke and Mirrors, strongly critiquing the paramilitary demobilization process. And then finally, we have Carl Meacham, senior Latin American staffer for the Republicans on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In this capacity, he authored December 2005 Senate staff report, Plan Colombia, Elements for Success. I'd just like to say here that USIP is a fully nonpartisan organization, and in that vein, we did try and get a number of speakers from the Democratic side of Capitol Hill, obviously due to the retaking by the Democrats of both houses of Congress. They are extraordinarily busy.
Nevertheless, in other words, he's saying that we don't have a lot of work, and that's why we could be here today.
Well, and I can say that all of them had very, very flattering things to say about Carl, and that having him on the panel alone would not unfairly bias the panel. Given the sometimes partisan rancor on Capitol Hill, I'm not sure if that just got him fired for having all those people say those nice things about him. We brought together this panel to discuss, in a pragmatic sense, where to from here. For those already well-versed in Colombia, please bear with me for the next few moments while I rehash what's been going on in the last few years with regards to Colombia and why this is kind of an important moment. 5 years ago, Álvaro Uribe was elected on a platform of promising to strengthen and extend government institutions and crack down on Colombia's ostensibly left-wing FARC insurgency. He fulfilled the latter crackdown while making modest, though some would argue negligible, progress on the front of expanding legitimate state institutions. Soon after his election, President Uribe began negotiations with the paramilitary forces for their voluntary dismemberment in exchange for the promise of non-extradition to the United States. An agreement was reached, and during the last 3 years, over 30,000 self-identified paramilitary combatants have turned in their weapons and entered into the agreed-to demobilization and reintegration programs. Witnessing these events, the second-largest left-wing guerrilla group, the ELN, approached the government about the possibility of negotiating their own DDR process as well. Currently, talks are slow, but ongoing in Cuba. Following Uribe's sweeping re-election victory in the beginning of the summer, the FARC also signaled a potential willingness to initiate a negotiation process with the government. In part connected to these events, Since 2002, murder rates, kidnappings, and most all crime statistics have dropped precipitously, leaving Colombia a generally safer and more stable society. Indeed, in the past few months, Colombia seemed to be on the edge of the hopeful moment for substantive progress towards peace, possibly towards ending 50 years of civil conflict. However, by the last few months of the year, cracks emerged in the rosy prospects, too big to gloss over in the hopes they'd just go away. Hopes for negotiation with the FARC diminished again, especially following a bombing in Bogota on a military base that the president attributed to the FARC. Simultaneously, significant flaws with the paramilitary demobilization process, along the lines that Maria laid out in great detail in a report, Smoke and Mirrors, had become too difficult to ignore. Moreover, by late summer, the process by which the demobilized ex-combatants were supposed to be reintegrated as functioning and productive members of civilian society seemed to be stagnating. In September, I went on a research expedition to Colombia, along with Will Owens, who has since left USIP to work at USAID, and Itziar Gomez, who's sitting in the back, to discover how the reintegration process was faring for these demobilized ex-paramilitaries. What we found was that the institutions set up to facilitate this process were mostly insufficiently resourced and unsatisfactorily prepared to accomplish their designated task. Many, if not most, of the demobilized we spoke with wanted to remain in civilian life. But the grossly inadequate access to jobs, income, education, and psychosocial counseling were contributing to the likelihood that by September 2007, this coming fall, the overwhelming majority of ex-combatants will have returned to some sort of illicit and likely violent lifestyle. The OAS has reported that paramilitary groups are reorganizing and at times in forms that are even more dangerous than in the past because of their lack of centralized control. Over the summer of 2006, both the international and domestic groups began to pressure the Colombian government to fully implement every aspect of the demobilization agreement that was signed with the paramilitaries. They pushed for complete application of the two previously drafted statutes, known collectively as the Peace and Justice Laws, and the Colombian Supreme Court edicts demanding more stringent set of conditions on the paramilitary leaders whom had already turned themselves in. Most of these leaders had been incarcerated at a former country club called La Ceja, but in December, the government forcibly transferred them to a maximum security prison called Itagüí. This prompted the leaders to rebel, calling for a truth commission, under the impression that if the truth, not only of their own crimes, but also all the names of the Colombian political figures complicit in their crimes, came out, they would be vindicated. Meanwhile, back in October, police forces in a raid seized the laptop computer of one of the top paramilitary leaders, Rodrigo Tovar Pupo, known as Jorge Forti. Before this, there were longstanding accusations of close collaboration between the paramilitaries and government officials across the country, some of which had forced the removal in fall of 2005 of Jorge Noguera, head of the state security agency, DAS. However, now these connections were substantiated by undeniable facts. Jorge Forti's hard drive had intricate details of paramilitary operations, including ironclad evidence of the complicity of high-ranking members of President Uribe's party. The brother of Colombia's foreign minister was implicated, and Colombia's Supreme Court indicted two senators, a congressman, and two former politicians on charges of collaboration with the paramilitary death squads in the Department of Sucre. Hundreds of government officials across the country were directly connected to death squads, narco-trafficking, and other major aspects of paramilitarismo. As a result of these scandals, confrontations, and more, the significant progress and hope of the past 2 or 3 years has been thrown into doubt. At this event, Dr. Mauricio Romero will discuss for about 15 minutes the impact the crisis is having on the political stability of Colombia and on the paramilitary demobilization, disarmament, and reintegration process. Maria McFarland will then comment on the impact and implications of recent events for human rights conditions and other marginalized populations in Colombia. And then Carl will discuss the impact of these events on U.S.-Colombian relations. So without further ado, I'd like to give the floor to Carl.
Mauricio.
I'm sorry, Mauricio.
Thank you, Jonathan, for inviting me to be here with you today. Jonathan asked me to talk about the impact the current crisis is having on political stability and the impact the crisis is having on demobilization, disarmament, and reintegration, the DDR process. First of all, I would like you to see this whole negotiation, or put a little bit more emphasis not only in the outcomes, but because sometimes those outcomes are unintended, but to see the process of the whole negotiation, to understand some surprising results of the negotiation. For example, like having in a maximum security prison, as Jonathan said, the former paramilitary chiefs. A year ago, nobody in Colombia, and not even the paramilitary chiefs, could have thought that they would have been in jail by the end of 2006. So, put attention in the process and not only in the outcomes, because sometimes those outcomes are unintended. It's not a rational result of the policies. The second point that I would like to stress as well is that this situation or this process is not over. It goes on. The process continues, and there might be more surprises in the future. We don't know. With this, I would like as well to stress the contingency of the whole situation in this political negotiation between the government and the AUC and the like. And mostly focusing on the local political context and how the government has been dealing with, has been handling this local political context, and the impact of this handling of the situation, the political situation in Colombia, the impact on the possibility of rebuilding democratic local institutions and civilian authority in the regions where there had been demobilization. I think this is very important, especially we have in mind that there are local elections in October of this year in Colombia. And secondly, the impact of the way the government has been handling this political process in Colombia, the impact on the prospects for peace with the ELN and the FARC. These two points, the rebuilding of democratic local institutions and civilian authority, not the authority of illegal armed groups, but civilian authority, and the prospects for peace are related. These two points are related. If there are signs in the regions of democratic institutional recovery or rebuilding, the prospects or the possibilities of peace with the ELN will be higher than they are now, especially if we take into consideration the local elections of October, as I said before. The political, the security conditions surrounding the electoral campaign will be a good thermometer of the local effects of the negotiation with the AUC and the like groups, like these paramilitary and self-defense groups. These surroundings conditions in terms of security for the opposition, mostly for the parties or groups in the regions opposing the coalition of forces, of political forces in supporting the President Uribe government, the Liberal Party and the Polo Democrático Alternativo, the equal conditions for all political players, for all political parties, democratic functioning of institutions, and as well a fair behavior of local authorities, including political and military and police authorities. These are the signals, the messages that the ELN in the short run and the FARC in the long run are going to evaluate in their analysis of the conditions to engage with the government in a peace negotiation. And these negotiations, and these local conditions are related to the quality of the process of reintegration in civilian life of the former combatants of the AUC. This is very important for the ELN. The ELN and the former combatants of the AUC share different regions, mostly in the north of the country, but as well in the center, in the middle Magdalena Valley, where the Bloque Central Bolívar, the mobilized, are the main forces of the ELN. So this quality of the process of reintegration as well is related to this to these political conditions and these security conditions surrounding the electoral campaign of October of this year. So the point that I want to make to stress is the relationship between the domestic political context, mostly all the political process associated with the re-election of President Uribe in May of past year, the effects that these dealings of this political process associated with the re-election, the effect on the possibility of rebuilding local institutions, the recovery of local institutions, and as well the relationship on the quality of reintegration of the former ex-combatants, and how these two points are going to affect the possibilities for peace in the future. So let's talk a little bit about the domestic political context, mostly of the context of 2006. Once the government and Congress were elected, the government was re-elected in March and May of 2006, priorities change for the government, for the president, and for their allies in Congress. The support of the social, economic, and political forces close to the paramilitary was not important anymore, or was not important as before, for the government and for the politicians. They were already re-elected. Besides, by May, June of 2006, the main paramilitary forces were demobilized. On top of that, we have the constitutional ruling by the Supreme Court hardening the peace and justice law. So we have a very particular situation in which political, military, and judicial conditions were not favorable anymore to the paramilitary chiefs. Was that intentional? Was that the result, a result of a rational choice of the policies by the government? I don't think so. That was like an intended consequence of the whole political process within Colombia and as well the pressures of the international forces, meaning United States, Congress in United States, European Community, etc. So we see these unfavorable conditions for the paramilitary chiefs, political, military, and judicial. And that helps to understand the reactions of a paramilitary leader like Vicente Castaño, brother of Carlos Castaño. And that helps to understand as well the discontent among the paramilitary chiefs that were first in La Ceja and then in Itagüí. Did the government look for this situation? As I said before, difficult to say. But if you see the first 2 years of the negotiation, the government and the paramilitary chiefs were thinking in a different scenario, much more beneficial for them and much more favorable for the government. The political opposition, mostly of the Polo Democrático, Independiente, or Alternativo, helped as well. Gustavo Petro in Congress opened the door to see how deep were the links between politicians, between paras and drug traffickers. The issue of truth came to the public arena much more stronger than before, and paradoxically giving the paramilitary chiefs in Itaúí a tool to bargain, to make a deal, at least to try to make a deal with the government. But it's not sure the paramilitary leaders are going to use it. It will be risky for them to confront the government, even especially if it has 70% of support by public opinion. This uncertain situation has created in the paramilitary chiefs, the ones that have demobilized or the ones that are not demobilized, big incentives to reorganize, as Jonathan said. New armed groups are appearing in different regions of Colombia, or some are saying that they are rearming or they are reorganizing themselves. Is there any link of the former paramilitary chiefs, of the chiefs in Itaúí, related to that, to the emergence of different groups in different areas of the country? I think that it's too soon to have a conclusive answer to this question. Human rights groups are saying in different regions of Colombia that former medium-level chiefs are reorganizing the groups, mostly in the Caribbean coast, in Norte de Santander, close to the Venezuelan border, in Middle Magdalena Valley, in some areas of Antioquia, and as well in Santander and the Llanos Orientales. So are these medium-sized or medium-level chiefs in connection with the paramilitary chiefs in Itaúí? There are not conclusive answers, as I said before. What I want to remark with these situations are the consequences at the local and regional level and the negative effects this situation is going to have for the local elections next October. Adding these situations to the uncertain circumstances, the difficulties, or the difficulties that the government has had in putting up a reintegration plan, beyond the fact of giving the former excombatants a monthly payment of 1.5 minimum wage for 18 or 24 months. As Jonathan said as well, these plans have been very weak. The government created an office at the highest level to deal with the process of reintegration in August of 2006. Fran Perl is in charge of this office. The risk is that it might be too late.
Too few?
Too few? Too little?
Too little, yeah. The risk is that that office and the program they are raising up is going to be too late and too little. Let's see what is Mr. Perl able to do in the next future. What is known is that this semester, the money will stop flowing to different paramilitary excombatants, and there are different alternatives for them. Going back to drug trafficking, being members of new organization, or could be unemployed. But this is a very difficult situation in different regions of Colombia for this year. So, some questions. Accepting the electoral support of the political, economical, and social forces close to the paramilitary forces improved or worsened. I'm talking about the re-election of the campaign of President Uribe, accepting the electoral support of these political, economic, and social forces close to the paramilitary, has improved or worsened the possibilities of rebuilding local institutions in a democratic framework. Did this behavior by the campaign of President Uribe compromise the democratic rebuilding of institutions in the regions? I think it did. If the perspectives of rebuilding the local state are bad, what is the government going to do? Do they have any alternative plan? So far, we haven't seen anything related to that. And talking in a longer run, what is going to happen with the negotiations with the ELN and with the FARC, having in mind these regional and local settings? So, Jonathan asked me to define a little bit how would be the political stability in Colombia in 2007. I would say it's uncertain. And he asked me to say something as well about reintegration. And I would say I see that it's going to be very difficult to do something about reintegration. So thank you very much for this invitation.
Thank you, Mauricio. Maria?
All right. Well, thank you, Jonathan, for organizing this forum and inviting me. I think this issue is of tremendous importance. And to understand the potential impact of these investigations on human rights in Colombia, we have to put them in a slightly broader context. That's because I think these investigations point to a fundamental tension that hasn't been resolved in Colombia, and that is how the country is going to view and treat paramilitaries. One vision, that is the vision put forth by paramilitaries themselves, is that they are basically people who were forced to respond to guerrilla violence by the abandonment by the state. So you know, they had to take up weapons, and they should now be forgiven for everything that happened. They were in a state where there was just constant violence, and this is just a result of that situation. The opposite view, or the alternative vision, is that of people who understand that paramilitaries may, in some areas, have started as groups that were trying to defend themselves or certain people's property from guerrillas. But today, they are groups who are deeply involved in drug trafficking, who for decades now have been massacring defenseless civilians, and who have been profiting from their criminal activities, and so, therefore, should be held accountable. The Uribe administration in Colombia has essentially taken the first position in its behavior, at least, even despite the fact that the United States has put paramilitary groups on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations and considers most of its leaders to be major drug traffickers and has requested their extradition to be tried here for drug trafficking. In fact, the demobilization negotiations started in Colombia in 2002 at the request of paramilitary commander Carlos Castaño, after the U.S. had put the paramilitaries on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations and after the U.S. Department of Justice announced the first indictments for paramilitary commanders and requested their extradition. Paramilitaries before had never really had anything to fear from the Colombian military. In fact, much of our work up to that point had been focused on documenting links between certain military units and paramilitary groups. So the one thing that they really feared was spending the rest of their days in a prison in Miami for drug trafficking. So their goal in this process was essentially to protect themselves from extradition to the U.S. and continue otherwise with business as usual, maintain as much of their structure intact as possible. And the Uribe administration went along with it. The first law that the Colombian government pressed for to govern the demobilization process would have essentially given them a complete amnesty. It would have been a suspended sentence in exchange for the payment of a fee. That at that time, paramilitaries were even invited to speak to the Colombian Congress as though they were heroes who had to be honored for being willing to demobilize or for all their service to the nation. It was only because of international pressure that the Uribe administration was forced to table that bill. But if it were up to them, today, that law would have passed, and paramilitary commanders like Mancuso, like Don Berna, would be free, would still have all their illegal fortunes, and might even be holding public office, for all we know. The law that the government finally pushed through Congress, the Justice and Peace Law, essentially contains the bare minimum that the Uribe administration thought was necessary to satisfy the requirements of the International Criminal Court. So it contains some basic sentences. It offers paramilitary commanders reduced sentences for all their atrocities, as well as protection from extradition to the United States. The law, as originally passed, however, did not even require these leaders to confess, and the law did nothing to ensure a real dismantlement of paramilitaries' criminal and financial structures. And it's important to remember here that paramilitaries really work like huge mafias these days. They control large chunks of territory, they're deeply involved in drug trafficking, and they're very wealthy. So it's very easy for them to demobilize troops, but then replace them with new hired guns as long as they keep their financial structures intact and their criminal networks intact. So the real test of a demobilization process for paramilitaries is whether they give up their money and whether they give up information that could be useful for dismantling those criminal networks and those financial structures. And the law that the government pushed for and passed did not contain any incentives for paramilitaries to do that. Because once granted, those sentence reductions were locked in. In other words, if paramilitaries lied to the authorities, if they hid their wealth, if they committed new crimes, there was no way to revoke those sentence reductions. Once granted, they were permanent. And the Uribe administration was able to get away with all this, in part because it's a very popular government. The Colombian public, understandably, is sick and tired of the abuses by the FARC, of the kidnappings and the bombings. And at the end of the Pastrana administration and its failed negotiations with the FARC, probably most of the public found Uribe's tough approach, the idea of confronting the FARC militarily, very appealing. Another factor here is that throughout the process, Uribe has been able to enjoy the unconditional support of the United States. Even when Uribe said that he was suspending extradition orders for paramilitary commanders who were participating in the demobilization process, we didn't hear anything from the State Department. No complaints. So, in any case, as I was saying, the Uribe administration has, on the one hand, been fighting the FARC, but it has essentially a double standard. And with the paramilitaries, it's been a process of constant concessions. And the only times when we've seen any movement, any progress towards actually dismantling paramilitary groups, it's been as a result of investigations and pressure by the media, by civil society, and on occasion by the international community. It's basically been like pulling teeth. And every time the government is pushed to take a step forward, as soon as people turn around, it takes another step back, or it makes new concessions. For example, many human rights groups and parts of the international community had asked the Uribe government to correct several problems in the Justice and Peace Law, like the confessions, like the issue of revocation of benefits. The administration rejected all of those proposals, and it took the Constitutional Court of Colombia last year to step in and actually uphold the Justice and Peace Law, but order that certain changes had to be made as a condition for the law to be upheld for anything like that to happen. But even then, as soon as the court decision came out, Uribe approved a decree that basically undid a couple of the most important decisions by the court that had to do with sentencing, and made new concessions to the paramilitary, saying, for example, that they could serve their reduced sentences on agricultural colonies instead of real prisons. Another example is the confinement of paramilitaries in the retreat house in La Ceja in August. It took the media coming out and revealing that paramilitaries were going to malls and enjoying this lavish lifestyle, spending money in fancy restaurants, for the government finally to react and say, well, no, this can't be another catedral like Pablo Escobar's. We're going to have to confine them somehow. But it was voluntary confinement. And it was only after even more media pressure and the fact that people became aware that paramilitaries were coming and going as they pleased from La Ceja that they were finally confined in a maximum security prison in Itaúí. But even there, they're still getting to use their cell phones. And they still have access to computers. And so they can still be in touch with all their mid-level commanders. Mauricio was just pointing out that we don't know if paramilitary commanders are really linked to these new groups that are forming. But the government doesn't seem to be doing anything to prevent them from having that contact. Now, the investigations into links between politicians and paramilitary groups that have been are being conducted now by the Supreme Court are probably another example of something that's happening independently of what the government wanted. It runs contrary to this basic rule of, you know, keeping things quiet and doing only the bare minimum that the government's required to do because of pressure. And in fact, the investigations didn't start as a result of any government policy, but rather as a result of an unusual event, which was the finding of Jorge Cuarenta's laptop, which contained all this evidence, reportedly, of over 500 assassinations that Jorge Cuarenta had supposedly ordered during the demobilization process, and of links that he had, apparently, with various politicians. And so it was thanks to the Attorney General's office that found the computer, and thanks to the Supreme Court, that the investigations were started, not thanks to any government policy. Now the question is whether all these investigations are going to get the political support that they need to flourish, or whether all of this is just going to be swept under the rug. And there are many forces in Colombia right now who want to put a stop to the investigations. They're making the argument, for example, that Colombia can't handle the truth, that too much of the political class, too many of the elites were involved with the paramilitaries, and so there's going to be some kind of disaster if all the truth comes to light. These same people also argue, along the lines of the first view of paramilitaries I was describing, that they shouldn't be held responsible, that ultimately all of this is the state's fault, because the state abandoned them, and so they had to resort to paramilitarism to fight the FARC or risk losing all they had. A good example of this is the letter that over 10,000 cattle ranchers recently sent to President Uribe, in which they admit to having formed and financed paramilitary groups, but say that they had to do it because the state had abandoned them. Ultimately, these arguments are designed just to cover up really serious crimes. The state and successive governments may have political responsibility for not having protected these people. However, it's individuals who committed the crimes. The paramilitaries are not heroes. They're not people who are just defending territory. They're essentially butchers. They're people who took whole parts of the country, not just by combating guerrillas, but by massacring defenseless civilians. And they're people who profited immensely from killing people who opposed their rule and from displacing millions of Colombians to take their land and use it for drug trafficking, to grow coca in, or for a variety of other criminal activities. And they also benefited from corrupting public officials, basically, rigging elections so that their candidates would win. The politicians, in turn, who benefited from those rigged elections are also not innocent. Neither are the officials who took their bribes or the generals who use the paramilitaries to conduct their dirty war. These aren't defenseless people who are abandoned by the state. These are people who took advantage of an armed group and benefited from it, and are still, in some cases, benefiting from it. So if Colombia is ever going to have any semblance of the rule of law and really going to dismantle these groups, it has to start investigating and bringing out the truth about all of this now. Now, it's possible that without real administration support, I mean real support from the Uribe administration, there will be some results. The Supreme Court has been very brave in taking the lead on these investigations. But they can only do so much because they're only allowed to handle cases involving current public officials. And in fact, we've heard already of one senator who resigned from the Senate so that the court would lose jurisdiction over his case. So much of the weight is actually going to be on the Attorney General's office, which is empowered to investigate anybody. But it's unclear whether that office has the capacity or the resources to do this effectively. At present, the office has 20 prosecutors, that's all, assigned to handle the demobilization process. And according to the head of that unit, they already have opened 100,000 cases. So it's very likely that these investigations into paramilitary's links with political powers or economic powers will get lost or bogged down in all of this. And even with all these efforts that have been made by the Attorney General's office and by the Supreme Court, it's important to note that there are two big groups here who haven't even been touched yet. One is the military. I understand that Salvatore Mancuso, in his confession today, accused two generals of having helped him in two massacres, but one of them is dead, and the other had already been convicted. So it's unclear whether anything more is going to happen with that. Unlikely, in fact. And we haven't heard anything about their financial backers either. So if this is going to produce any really big results that have a lasting effect on impunity and really start to dismantle these groups, it's going to be up to the media and civil society and, most importantly, the international community, particularly the United States, to press the Uribe administration and to support the institutions that are pushing these investigations forward. Interestingly, paramilitaries are, as I said before, considered terrorists in the U.S. and are major drug lords. So given that the U.S. has already spent over $4 billion fighting drugs in Colombia, you'd think that the U.S. would be interested in dismantling paramilitary groups and holding accountable their leaders and uncovering as much as possible of their support networks. But over the last 6 years, the Bush administration has shown no real interest in pressing for this. In fact, almost every 6 months, it certifies that Colombia has been meeting conditions established in U.S. law relating to human rights, one of which requires that Colombia arrest paramilitaries' financial backers and thereby dismantle their structures. Obviously, Colombia is not meeting that condition, but State Department just keeps certifying by rote. The U.S. State Department also, in the last couple of years, pushed to fund the demobilization process unconditionally. It was only thanks to people in Congress, like Senator Lugar, that some very weak, but some conditions were established on that assistance. Now the problem is, of course, that those conditions are not being enforced, just like the other human rights conditions. So it's probably now going to be up to Congress to take action on this and start looking at tightening conditions on U.S. assistance, you know, take another look at the language, and asking tough questions of state. You know, try and push state to really enforce existing conditions more rigorously. Congress and state should also look at increasing U.S. support for institutions of justice in Colombia, such as the Attorney General's office, such as the courts and the Inspector General's office. Most U.S. assistance to Colombia is military in nature, and very little has so far been spent on institutions of justice, even though they need a great deal of assistance. And the U.S. should really start using its leverage in Colombia more effectively. There are two tools at U.S. disposal that have a huge impact in Colombia. One is extradition, which unfortunately the State Department, the U.S., has not really been willing to press on, it seems like. State has accepted Uribe's suspension of extradition orders for paramilitary commanders and hasn't really said much about conditions related to extradition for demobilization assistance. But a lot more could be done with that. And the other way in which state can exercise pressure is with visa revocation. It may surprise some people here, but the U.S. has the ability to revoke the visas of people who have links to paramilitary groups. And when it has done so, it's been very effective. It has a huge impact in Colombia when somebody's visa gets revoked, in public opinion and in terms of the person's own, shame. So to just wrap up, I think the start of these investigations by the Supreme Court is a positive development, but it's something that runs counter to everything that the Colombian government has been doing on this issue. And so for these investigations to go anywhere, then the international community, along with the media and civil society, are going to have to put a lot more emphasis, do a lot more monitoring, and press the Colombian government a lot more strongly to get results. Thanks.
Thank you, Maria. Carl?
Hey, I, beforehand, I apologize. I'm going to have to leave a little earlier. But what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to just go straight to the point. I think the previous speakers have done a good job of telling you a little bit about the law itself, both domestically in Colombia and the analysis of the law and where it stands in its application. What I'm going to tell you a little bit about is the implications that it has here in the U.S., in the U.S. Congress. The recent developments, that is the finding of the Jorge 40 laptop and the information there about the president's political party's involvement or cozy relationship with the Paras, I think has done two things. On the one hand, it's brought to light a lot of information that we kind of thought was there in the first place. And the second point, it's raised a question, which is how far up does this involvement go? With regards to policy in general, I think the bottom line that this event produces is that there's increased skepticism, and I'd say a loss in confidence that we're going to be able to get a return on our investment. I think Maria was pretty clear in talking about how much money we have invested in Colombia, something like over $4 billion, and Colombia still is producing the same amount of cocaine that it did when we started, and we still have issues with regards to human rights. The new Congress, our new Congress, is probably going to be much more skeptical, I think, about Plan Colombia in general. Demobilization is a part of Plan Colombia, but the environment that we see here are the events that we've seen here are going to affect how people support Plan Colombia. And I would say that the orientation of the two parties, Republicans and Democrats, in general, Republicans have been focused more on the anti-drug issues, and Democrats have been more focused on the human rights issues, not to say that that's exclusive. I do believe that those two things are complementary when we work them together. But if there's a perception that the government will not be able to implement these programs or that it is dragging its feet in implementing these programs, I think that you're going to find more questions from the two sides. And I think it's going to be much more difficult for Colombians to get the kind of treatment that they've received in the past. They'll be much more questioning. There'll be much more, there might be more conditions, as Maria talked about, with regards to Plan Colombia in general. So I think that's something new. As far as my boss's specific interests, and again, you know, folks have mentioned this already, the two issues are the verification of the paras when they demobilize. It's lacking. There needs to be much more aggressive take in doing that. And then with regards to the seizure of assets, land, and money, we're not seeing very much in that regard. For us, that's very important because I think it's close to 50% of paras, it's documented that they're involved in drug trafficking. So if you can deal with paramilitaries and taking their assets and their land, you're doing a good thing with regards to the war on drugs. The last issue I'd say is that there are larger implications to this as well. The Colombians are interested in a free trade agreement. The president's fast-tracked authority is finished in June of this year. There's a very short window for them to be able to push this initiative in the Congress. And the more complications you see in things like Plan Colombia, the more complications there'll be in things like the free trade agreement. So it's not that it just affects Plan Colombia or just demobilization needs to be applied better, but it affects a broader approach to our policy with Colombia. I think the Colombians need to be aware of this. I think we've demonstrated our commitment to them for years now and our interest in helping them with some of their domestic issues, and we're interested in dealing with the issues that relate directly to us. There has been advances in Colombia with regards to Plan Colombia about stability in everyday life for folks, but a lot more could be done. So I'm just going to leave it at that.